From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Chuck Jones has worked with some of the biggest names in his field: Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, and The Roadrunner. Jones is the animation director responsible for many of Warner Brothers' greatest cartoons. We meet Chuck Jones on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, Lester Bowie tells us about the R&B bands he played with before he co-founded the pace-setting Art Ensemble of Chicago. Jazz pianist Dave McKenna welcomes April. And critic Laurie Stone reviews the movie Camille Claudel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze met with President Bush at the White House for more than 2 hours today, twice as long as expected. Shevardnadze said the upcoming summit between the U.S. and the Soviet Union will be a major event in world affairs. More from NPR's White House correspondent Jim Engel.
Shevardnadze said he and the president talked about everything from arms control to regional conflicts to global problems. Shevardnadze said the wide-ranging discussions were particularly important in preparing for the upcoming summit, where the U.S. and the Soviet Union will be signing what he called very important documents in such areas as arms control and trade, among others. Shevardnadze also confirmed the Soviets are moving away from an insistence that a united Germany remain neutral. The U.S. has insisted that some NATO troops remain on German soil. Though the Soviet view appears to be changing, Shevardnadze did not offer any details.
Those ideas are being worked out, are being shaped now, and I think it is possible that we will be able to find a mutually acceptable way.
A way, he said, to make sure a united Germany will never threaten anyone. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
The Soviet foreign minister also said today that he and Secretary Baker will hold another round of talks in mid-May. The talks are aimed at overcoming remaining obstacles to a treaty reducing long-range nuclear weapons. He didn't say where the talks would be held, but they're expected to take place in Moscow. Saying his country is not ready for independence, the Communist Party chief in Latvia, Janos Vargas, is urging his fellow Latvians not to follow Lithuanians' bid for complete freedom from the Soviet Union. In a speech to the party congress, Vargas said he feels Latvia will need a transition period of 5 to 10 years to include gradual lessening of ties to Moscow. The BBC's Tim Huell reports from Moscow.
In his opening speech to the congress, Mr. Vargas outlined three possible ways forward for Latvia. It could remain part of a unitary Soviet Union, as some hardliners in the local party would like. It could follow the Lithuanians by forming a separate communist party and declaring independence. Or it could take a third road, involving a gradual transition to independence, both for the local communist party and for the republic itself. Mr. Vargas said the first option was unacceptable and the second unrealistic. But the third, he said, would allow Latvia to solve its economic and demographic problems before it fully took charge of its own affairs. By demographic, he clearly meant the need to stop immigration from other parts of the Soviet Union, which has led to a situation where ethnic Latvians now make up just half the population of the republic.
The BBC's Tim Huell. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 2,717.12. Declines led advances 4-3 in moderate trading of 137 million shares. This is NPR. Colombia's top security policeman said a bomb that was defused yesterday in Bogota could have killed 5,000 people if it had exploded. The 1,700-pound bomb was hidden in a truck parked in a wealthy suburb of the capital. The planting of the bomb appears to mark the beginning of new terrorist assaults by Colombia's drug traffickers. In a statement issued to newspapers today, leaders of the drug cartels vowed to step up attacks against the country's political and industrial establishment. Both Democrats in the Texas governor's race are facing accusations of past drug abuse in what's become the major issue in next Tuesday's primary runoff. Tom Olson of member station KERA in Dallas has more.
Attorney General Jim Maddox has accused State Treasurer Ann Richards of using drugs, but has declined to release affidavits from alleged witnesses. Now Maddox faces the same accusations of drug abuse brought by a Dallas vice officer and Houston attorney who say they saw Maddox smoke marijuana on two occasions during the 70s. Maddox called the 11th hour charges lies.
I don't ever remember being in close quarters where people, you know, that were familiar to me were smoking marijuana.
Maddox and Richards meet Tuesday in a runoff ending one of the most vicious primary election campaigns in Texas politics. For National Public Radio, I'm Tom Olson in Dallas.
Palestine Liberation Organization Chief Yasser Arafat said today that he had secret contacts with Israeli leaders to discuss the Mideast peace process. Arafat told Italian television that he's been contacted by envoys from top-level Israeli leaders, including former Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir. President Bush said today that former President Jimmy Carter was acting on his own in meeting this week with Palestine Liberation Chief Yasser Arafat. The president said his administration nearly neither approved or disapproved of Mr. Carter's efforts to reactivate the Mideast peace process. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the man behind many of the Looney Tunes stars. Animation director Chuck Jones created many now classic cartoons featuring Daffy Duck, Bugs Bunny, Elmer Fudd, and Porky Pig. He created the characters Pepe Le Pew, the Roadrunner, and Wile E. Coyote. Jones worked at Warner Brothers from 1933 until the studio closed down its cartoon division in 1963. Then he formed his own production company and created primetime TV specials, including Rikki Tikki Tavi and A Connecticut Rabbit in King Arthur's Court. Jones has written an autobiography called Chuck Amuck. The title is borrowed from Duck Amuck, Jones's cartoon about cartooning. In Duck Amuck, Daffy Duck finds himself at the mercy of a fickle cartoonist. Daffy opens the cartoon as a brave musketeer, but the cartoonist keeps changing the scenery on him to the most inappropriate settings, a farm, the Arctic, Hawaii. The cartoonist eventually erases not only the background, but Daffy himself.
Would it be too much to ask if we could make up our minds? Dashing through the snow, through the fields we go, laughing all the way. Farewell to thee, farewell to thee. The wind will carry back our sad refrain. One last embrace before we say, Buster, it may come as a complete surprise to you to find that this is an animated cartoon. And that in animated cartoons, they have scenery. And in all the years All right, wise guy, where am I?
Chuck Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. You changed a lot of the characters who you worked with over the years.
Uh-huh.
And can you describe, when you first started directing Daffy Duck, who was always my favorite, when you started directing Daffy Duck, what was he like? And then maybe you could tell us a little bit of the character changes that you brought to the Daffy.
It's a little difficult to isolate them exactly as to what I contributed, but I all the characters I felt were part of me, particularly Daffy and the Coyote, because they made the kind of mistakes that most of us make, only multiplied a bit. But Daffy was an interesting character, I think, because he would rush in and fear to tread at the same time. And he also could be fawning and overbearing at the same time. And I think that happens with very many of us when we, sometimes in the reverse, when we go in to talk to the boss and ask for a raise, we're overbearing. When we get inside, we're fawning. But Daffy is both at the same time. At the beginning, he was just crazy, as was Bugs, even in the first great, Wild Hare that Tex Avery directed. The character was really kind of mad, more like Harpo Marx, perhaps. And I was never comfortable with a character unless I could understand him, and I can't understand crazy people. So I always try to sort of pasteurize my characters to find out who they are. Who is the whole point about character animation is not what. It isn't what a character looks like or indeed how it's drawn.
You sound like a method animator.
Well, I guess so. I don't think that I could do it unless I cared about the characters.
In your cartoon, Duck Amuck, why did you choose Daffy Duck as the character that was going to be at the whim of the cartoonist?
Well, I tried it later with Bugs Bunny and it didn't work. Fortunately, I did Duck Amuck first, then I did one called Rabbit Rampage, and he also had the same problem, and the person in this case turned out to be Elmer Fudd that was moving him around. But it didn't work because that's not the kind of a person that Bugs is. Bugs is a comic hero, you see, as compared with a comic wimp, which would go back to all the great comedians, starting with Chaplin and Buster Keaton and all the rest of them. They were, they're all kind of semi-losers, aren't they? They're more like us. And but I always liked Daffy because he would continue beyond where I would stop simply because I'd be afraid of what the community would think of me. Daffy continues, so... But when I was working with him, all I had to do was reach down inside of me and bring the Daffy up to the surface and spread it out and take a look at it and see what would I do if I had Daffy Duck's courage.
Mm-hmm. Chuck Jones is my guest, and he directed many of the Warner Brothers cartoons during the heyday of the animation studio, and he directed many of the big stars like Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, and Porky Pig. He also created the characters Pepe Le Pew and Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. You told us a little bit about how you changed Daffy Duck and how you drew him a little differently, different characteristics you gave him. What about Bugs Bunny? What are some of the changes you brought to Bugs's life?
Well, I think one of the nice things about there were three units there. After 1946, in fact, all the films that Warner now owns were directed by Fritz Feeling or Bob McKimson or me. Bob Clamp had left in 46 and Tex around 44. And... So we had these wonderful sessions. When I would get an idea for a film, or my writer and I would get an idea for a film, we'd call in the other directors and writers, and we'd sit down and have this session, which we called a yes session, which meant for 2 hours nobody could say anything negative. If you couldn't contribute to the idea, your job was to shut up. But usually the ideas were pretty good when they came in. The result of this was that we were all involved with each other's picture, although each director had absolute control of what went into his own pictures. But there was no internecine warfare. We liked each other. We wanted each other to succeed. But if I gave a great gag to Fritz Freeling and he used it, and it appeared on the screen and got an enormous laugh, naturally I wanted to go out and throw up. But because that's human nature, that's Daffy Duck in me.
When you did your recording sessions, the voice sessions with Mel Blanc, mm-hmm. what kind of suggestions would you make to him about the characteristics that he should try to be getting at through his voice?
Well, for one thing, I'd have completely laid out the picture. All the key drawings that I would be giving to the animators had already been done, and I would already have finished the exact dialogue. Mel never sat in on story things or anything like that. And in no way could we let any actor, Mel or anybody else, ad-lib, because we had to make pictures exactly to 6 minutes. So the dialogue was all carefully planned to fit into an exact 6-minute format. So when I was ready for the actor, usually Mel, about an hour before we were to record, I'd call him in. The marvel of Mel was that he was such a brilliant actor that he could immediately get the idea of what you were talking about.
All the great characters of the Warner Brothers cartoons are all animals. They're animals with the traits of people, but they're not people. They're ducks and rabbits and skunks. What are some of the advantages of using animals instead of people for the cartoons?
Well, we had ample precedents to go on. I mean, going back to Aesop's Fables and Kipling, and even Mark Twain did several things about animals, and of course Beatrix Potter and... So many others, but the main thing is that it's easier to humanize animals than it is to humanize humans, and it's as you know from seeing Snow White and the Poor Princes and all the Disney films, it's very difficult to animate human beings, and when we did animate them, they didn't look very much like human beings. I mean, Elmer Fudd doesn't look any more like a human being than Bugs Bunny looks like a rabbit. Bugs is obviously not a rabbit. Rabbits look more like... And the average rabbit looks very much more like a pillow than anything else. However, I think that taking a rabbit and making him as heroic as Bugs Bunny is a lot more easy than it is to take a human being and make him like Bugs, with Bugs' characteristics.
You always believe that in a cartoon world that you have to create certain rules of the universe, and the characters always have to live within those rules. Give us an example through, say, the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote cartoons, because you created those characters.
Yes.
What's tell us a little bit about the universe that you created them in.
Well, there are several things that happen in all comedy. The more you channelize, the more you narrow your character down, the better it gets. For some reason, take Charlie Chaplin, when he once got that little costume, look how much he was restricted in what he could do. He could only be the little tramp, but he could be the little tramp and he also limited the little tramp in pretty much into living in a city. Well, we felt that when we got the Roadrunner and Coyote going, it was evident that they both lived in the southwestern American desert. And so you immediately say to yourself, that's where they live, that's where they got to live. And the fact that the Roadrunner is a Roadrunner means that he should stay on the road. And there were a number of other rules about that, that the Roadrunner can never harm the Coyote. The Coyote can only harm himself by buying those unfortunate things he gets from the Acme Corporation. So on. So that's what we... And the more rules you apply, you never hear any other sound except the beep beep. And I found that going back then to Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny is such a powerful character, and he's a comic hero rather than a loser. He's such a powerful character that he could become a terrible bully. So we always started Bugs in every picture. We started him in a natural rabbit environment, minding his own business, a quiet living rabbit, something like Rex Harrison, perhaps, before he got involved with My Fair Lady, ladies. And then someone comes along and tries to deprive him of his foot or his life, or he's, you know, or sending him up in a rocket or something, and then he has to fight back, you see. And when once engaged in the war, then he's happily engaged. But without that, he would just be a bully. And there were some characters like Heckle and Jekyll and Woody Woodpecker at some time seemed to go out and just heckle people for no particular reason. Bugs never did that. And this is vital and necessary if you wanted the character to be believable and for people to care about him.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk about cartoons some more. And my guest is Chuck Jones, who directed many of the classic Warner Brothers cartoons. And he directed Bugs Bunny, Daffy Duck, Porky Pig, Elmer Fudd. He created the characters of Pepe Le Pew and Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote. Chuck Jones has written his autobiography. It's called Chuck-a-Muck, The Life and Times of an Animated Cartoonist. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Chuck Jones is my guest. One of the characters you created was Pepe Le Pew, this skunk who thinks he's very debonair and quite irresistible, but he's really quite repulsive. He has no idea. And he has this great fractured French that he speaks. As a matter of fact, let me just play a little excerpt of Pepe Le Pew, and this is from a cartoon that you won an Academy Award for, Sentimental Reasons.
Quelle est? Ah, the petite femme skunk. The rendezvous, no? Ah, my darling, how beautiful you are. How lonesome it has been that I have without you. The sweet nothings. The sweet somethings. The tender enrapturements. But I forget. But of course, the rendezvous.
Why did Pepe Le Pew have to be a French skunk?
Because it's funnier that way.
Uh-huh.
A Bulgarian skunk probably wouldn't have been as interesting, or any Egyptian skunk. So, I don't know, French, that the idea that French believe that they are the most desirable of all men, I don't know, that's still prevalent, but at that time we thought of them that way. But I was a complete wimp in high school, and I was 6'1", weighed 132 pounds, so girls looked right through me and could see other men. So I suppose it was natural for me to find to compensate for that by making a character who, regardless of what he was, believed he was an absolute, the most desirable of all people.
Did Marie Chevalier ever say anything about this character?
I don't really know whether he did or not. I imitated him a couple of times. We had him sing a couple of songs the way Chevalier would have sung them.
Uh-huh.
We never ever imitated any character completely.
Right.
But sometimes we would infuse a little bit of a lot of characters, like George Sanders eating a chicken wing is very much like Bugs Bunny eating a carrot.
Now, I grew up on the Warner Brothers cartoons, and the older I'd get, the more jokes I'd get. But I never realized I was missing anything when I was young, you know, because I always liked them. And now as an adult, I see things that I didn't see when I thought I was getting all the jokes when I was an older kid. Did anyone at Warner Brothers ever give you an argument that certain things there would go over the head of the heads of the audience?
Yeah. Yes, they did. But we didn't pay attention to them. We always had going battles on with our producers. So they would issue edicts like, don't make any pictures about bullfights. Bullfights aren't funny. Well, that immediately would say, well, gee, obviously the guy has always been wrong. So we made a picture about a bullfight, and it turned out fine. No, we had very little problem. Fortunately, our producers were not very bright.
Well, who did you have to answer to?
Nobody. Because our pictures went out with the Warner Brothers features, and they were always played in theaters. And we really didn't know anything about how they were received until eventually we would get word from the exhibitor, who, after all, was the one who could judge his audience's response. So, no, we only made them for ourselves. We never made them for anybody else. We couldn't preview, and we weren't allowed to. There were no such things as these idiotic demographics and Nielsen ratings and stuff. And the first critic hadn't been born, so we just tried to amuse one another, and it seemed to work.
I remember once seeing a short film that was a combination of kind of pornographic cartoons that some of the Disney animators drew in their off hours.
Yeah.
And it ended up getting into circulation. Did you guys ever do anything like that at Warner Brothers? Yeah?
Yeah, everybody did that. In fact, sometimes when in a Pepe Le Pew picture, I would I'd put a little salacious one frame in 1/24th of a second. And I'd actually put it in the picture. And then I'd ask the office manager to come in. I said, there's a little glitch here. There's a certain hop at this point. I don't know what it, I can't figure out what it is. And then I'd bring it to a stop in the moviola, and, you know, that thing when you look through, and there it would be, you know. Well, I knew nobody could ever see it because it was 1/24th of a second. But then he would go into shock, you know. And we always had a frame to replace it just in case, but I enjoyed doing that. It kind of put him in his place.
So did he make you take that out, or did those frames stay?
No. I told him it was too late. It would cost money to take it out, and nobody would ever see it. But I had already inserted it. It wasn't there anyway. But I did it to see if I couldn't put him into, as we used to say, reduce him to moccasins.
Were any of your scenes or any of your language ever censored?
No, that was left to the brilliant people at the networks, and they take out things that make the whole thing incomprehensible.
Did that happen a lot, that you felt your cartoons were butchered when they got on TV?
Oh, yes, they were, both at CBS and ABC, to name a few of the guilty ones. What's curious to me is that they feel it was necessary to chew up those cartoons, but Nickelodeon, which is a program that's supposedly designed for children, sees no need to do that.
Well, how did the networks edit the cartoons? What kinds of material would they find offensive?
Oh, practically everything. In the Bugs Bunny and Rabbit Season, Duck Season things, they would take out every shot in which somebody, you know, those shots where Daffy's bill would be shot around. They'd show him getting ready to shoot, then they'd cut out the part of the shooting, and then they'd come back, and the poor child hadn't the remotest idea what happened.
Because they thought that it was too violent?
Yeah.
And what years are you talking about?
You couldn't even hit somebody with a pie, for God's sake.
What years are you talking about that this kind of censorship
is? Oh, it's true now. You can still see the films that way.
But when I was growing up in the 50s, I think...
No, they weren't.
They were on fully.
Yes, they were. They didn't do all that idiotic stuff. Listen, to me, a person who bears the title of program practices means censorship, and it are people that are too fat to run and too cowardly to fight.
I'd imagine that the cartoons that had gotten the most objections because of the violence with the Roadrunner cartoons, since they're all chase.
Well, that's absurd, though, because the Roadrunner... the Roadrunner never harmed the coyote. The coyote was only a victim of his own ineptitude.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that there was any violence involved there is ridiculous.
Did you ever think of yourself as doing a pop kind of surrealism?
I did some, they tell me. But I never did anything you know, by sitting down and saying, I'm doing this for a reason.
Right.
What I was trying to do was to develop the characters that I understood and to have fun doing it. And that's what, that was the whole secret of Warner Brothers cartoons, is a bunch of people happened to come together from varied walks of life, all of whom were enormously interested in making films that were fun to do.
I'd like to hear your impressions of cartoons today, both the Saturday morning cartoons on television and the state-of-the-art Roger Rabbit-type animation.
Well, of course, the kid vid stuff, that's an ugly term. I always felt that is so patronizing of children. And as I said with the audiences, I believe that you must give everything that you have if you're making a picture so-called for children. Well, as I said, there are a lot of talented people who are making this trash for Saturday morning, where you cannot tell anything about a character by the way it moves, but only by the way it sounds or what it looks like. Also, there's a terrible thing that's happened, is that it seems to imply that the only way that children, or, I mean, anybody can handle anything, for instance, either the Smurfs or the Mighty Orbots or whatever they are, is that if somebody comes in to present danger, everybody gets together and fights them. Well, the history of comedy and the history of drama and the history of history indicates that the only thing that ever counts is the triumph of the individual. And our characters might fail occasionally. They might be violent. I don't know what they were, but I do know that they were always individuals. Whatever the problems they had, is they were obeying the rules that Bruno Bettelheim said, and that it's good for children to read violent stories about dragons and, you know, those things, because it indicates that even the most terrifying thing can be overcome by goodness and honesty and, you know, and humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I thoroughly believe that. I don't see how anybody else can, how you can gainsay such things.
We just have a few seconds left, but what about Roger Rabbit?
Well, let me give you a quick rule then. In any creative work, only two things should show. You put in work and you put in love. And afterward, the only thing that should show is love. The love should show, what you put into it, whether you like that love or not. In Roger Rabbit, to me, it was a triumph of work. And everybody that looks at it says, wasn't that marvelous, all that marvelous stuff that went into there of creating the business between live action and animation. This is absolutely true. But I was so disappointed because I didn't care about Roger. To me, he was an unpleasant character. And I care about Bugs Bunny, and everybody, like last night when we had this opening at the bookstore, and these people came in, and every one of them, this one man said, God, I wanted to come up and talk to you, but my heart's beating so much because I love your characters, and I care about them. You know, he didn't say that, but he said, I love them so much that I just couldn't stand coming up and seeing somebody that had something to do with them. God, that's my problem with Roger Rabbit. To me, the most appealing character in there was, among all these animated characters, was Bob Hoskins.
Animation director Chuck Jones. His memoir is titled Chuck Amuck. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Hey, kids! What time is it?
It's Howdy Doody time!
Trumpeter Lester Bowie brings a sense of theater to his shows with the Art Ensemble of Chicago and his own group, Brass Fantasy. Coming up, Bowie tells us how he developed that style while touring with R&B bands. Also, jazz pianist Dave McKenna plays some April songs. And critic Laurie Stone reviews the movie Camille Claudel. It's the story of Auguste Rodin's lover and her eventual descent into madness. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Prospects for completing a major nuclear arms control agreement before the next superpower summit are fading. And as Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze wound up 3 days of talks in Washington, both sides were doubtful even a framework would be ready in time. Barry Schwide reports.
There was always some question whether the treaty, with all its detail, would be ready for President Bush and Soviet President Gorbachev to sign. But at least a framework was supposed to be ready for initialing by the leaders, with the treaty itself to be signed later in the year. Now it turns out even initialing may be impossible. Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze said a lot of hard work would have to be done in advance of the May 30th summit, and White House Press Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said it may be that only some of the issues will be settled before Gorbachev arrives from Moscow. Among the issues still unresolved are ways to verify compliance with the pact and the kind of limits that would be put on air and sea-launched cruise missiles. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
President Bush cautioned the Soviet foreign minister today that a crackdown against the breakaway Republic of Lithuania would be a setback to superpower relations. While on the German issue, Secretary of State Baker said that while the Soviets had eased their demand that a unified Germany be neutral, they continued to object to its membership in NATO. The Pentagon, which has been touting the pinpoint accuracy of the stealth fighter bomber, admitted today that one of the aircraft used in the invasion of Panama dropped its bomb way off target. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Earlier this week, the Pentagon confirmed that two stealth fighter bombers were deployed in the U.S. invasion of Panama in December and dropped laser-guided bombs near a barracks of the Panamanian Defense Forces. Well, it turns out that one of those bombs missed its target, and the Air Force didn't even let Defense Secretary Dick Cheney in on the secret. The missed target was blamed on a lack of communications between the two pilots involved. Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams said he didn't find out about the error until after Tuesday's briefing, in which he disclosed some long classified details about the F-117A. Williams said Cheney found out at the same time. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Seven members of a House Armed Services subcommittee are traveling to Asia this weekend to look at alternative sites for U.S. military bases now in the Philippines. The legislators will also look at U.S. security responsibilities in that area and visit Vietnam and Cambodia. In the Philippines, officials have criticized the current agreement for the U.S. bases. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 4 points to close at 2,717.12. On volume of some 137 million shares. Declining issues edged out advances. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. It's spring. Taxes are just about due. And here's something else you can add to the list of seasonal inevitabilities, hearing different versions of Take Me Out to the Ball Game on public radio. This version has become one of our favorites. It was recorded in our studio by Boston-based pianist Dave McKenna, who joins us today.
I got a little medley of spring songs. More specifically, these tunes have April in the title. So here's wishing you a green and pleasant spring.
Thank you.
Dave McKenna playing in the Fresh Air Studio. His April medley featured the songs April in Paris, Lost April, and I'll Remember April. Dave McKenna's latest recording, live at Maybeck Recital Hall, is on Concord Records. This is Fresh Air. The Art Ensemble of Chicago emerged from the experimental jazz scene of the 60s and still maintains its position as a premier avant-garde band. The group's founding trumpeter is my guest, Lester Bowie. In addition to his work with the Art Ensemble, Bowie leads his own group, Brass Fantasy. Bowie has developed a reputation for his off-kilter interpretations of rhythm and blues classics. Start playing rhythm and blues standards with the band?
Well, when I first started playing professionally at age 15, I played with a group called the Continentals that was backing up a lot of doo-wop groups during that time. This is 1954 to 59. And one of the first songs that I learned was The Great Pretender. So, assuming that jazz always expounded on contemporary music, I was always confused as to why jazz guys never really picked up on what was happening for the doo-wop guys in the 50s. So to pick up that slack and to fill that space, I decided to do it myself.
Did you ever turn your back on those songs yourself because they weren't jazz and you were a jazz musician?
No, I've always been a professional musician first. I always tell any student that I have that if you want to be a jazz musician, you first have to learn how to feed yourself with the instrument. After that, you can specialize. And another thing, we in jazz aren't supposed to be so closed-minded as to turn our backs on any kind of music.
Did playing with people like Solomon Burke and Jackie Wilson, Rufus Thomas, Gladys Knight, Patti LaBelle give you a sense of the theater of music?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. And it taught me a lot about staging and just how music moves and how it affects people.
Did you do steps and wear jackets, and did you have synchronized horn movements?
I did the steps, we wore the jackets, but I didn't like the fast moves. You know, one time I auditioned for James Brown. Actually, I auditioned 3 times. I never got the gig, but I was always glad I didn't because I didn't want to flip my trumpet around like that. I was scared. That's the only trumpet I had.
Well, you mentioned James Brown. You do Papa's Got a Brand New Bag on your new record. Tell me why you chose that one.
Well, for 2 reasons. James Brown has been one of the influential people in music since I was in high school, since 1955. And his being incarcerated now, I think I think he shouldn't be incarcerated. I think we should free James Brown and put him in the nut house, take him out of jail and put him in the nut house. But he shouldn't be in jail like that. And this is just part of our homage and our respect for his music and what he's done for jazz and what it's done for rhythm and blues, what it's done for the rap music of today. He's truly the godfather of soul.
Let me ask you about your playing. You tend to play in the cracks between notes a lot, and You do these flub notes that are perfectly controlled. You know exactly, or you seem to know exactly how you're going to miss a note. And I was wondering how you develop that kind of technique.
Well, I used to tell people I've built a whole career off making mistakes. What I do is, if I make a mistake, I just learn how to do it on purpose. So then I've got the note that I should have hit, then I get the note that I didn't hit, but I know how to make both of them on purpose.
Well, do you think of yourself as having a lot of technique as a player?
Well, I've probably got the most advanced technique in brass as far as the newer elements that I use. I don't have the best by any means as far as the standard trumpet classical technique, but who cares?
Mm-hmm. Did you ever care?
Nope, Fred, not. At the time, my father was a classical musician, trained as a classical musician in the 30s, and when he came up, there was no hope of a black man ever getting any, being with the symphony orchestra in the States, so I didn't even consider that. It was never part of my, never part of it. Mm-hmm. Plus, the music kind of bored me a little bit, too.
You started playing trumpet when you were very young, right?
Right, 5 years old.
It seems really young for any kind of wind instrument, but how do you know an instrument's right for you when you're that young?
Well, I didn't have any choice. My father was a trumpet player, so he says, you're going to play this trumpet or die. So I figured, you know, it's better than dying. But see, I've been playing so long, I don't even remember learning. I mean, ever since I can remember, I've been playing trumpet.
We were talking before about the theatricality of music and the matching jackets that you'd have to wear when you were playing with rhythm and blues bands and doo-wop groups. You wear a lab coat when you perform with Brass Fantasy. How did you start using that as your stage uniform?
Well, I started using I've used a lot of different ones. I've been a priest, I've been a hard hat. But the white jacket kind of stands for research. And I've been a researcher, and I consider the stage as my laboratory.
You always look to me like the mad scientist when you wear it. You know, that you're cooking something up in your laboratory.
Yeah, Jack Sheldon once told me that I was was like a psychiatrist gone berserk or something.
Let me change the subject to the Art Ensemble of Chicago. What part of your playing and your personality does that group bring out?
Well, the Art Ensemble is the artistic, the research, the multi-ethnic, influential, heavy. I believe this is the most difficult music that I play is with the Art Ensemble. I can play things with the Art Ensemble that everyone else wouldn't know what to do, but just hold their eyes open wide. So it's the most advanced musically of all the groups.
Did you think of yourself as being an avant-garde player when you helped form the group in 1965?
No, we didn't. We never considered ourselves avant-garde. I mean, people considered us avant-garde. We've been trying to live that down now for the last 25 years. So it's because avant-garde has a sort of a negative connotation. When people think of avant-garde, it means something that they're going to have difficulty understanding, something that's going to be maybe chaotic and avant-garde doesn't really mean that. It means just something that's a little bit ahead of its time. It doesn't necessarily mean it's atonal or it's a bunch of confusing sounds that may be difficult to decipher. So it's kind of hard to live that down, and that label was kind of stuck on us.
Well, the Art Ensemble is really a group that not only plays, you know, challenging music, but it's a group that really knows how to have fun, and that is also like Brass Fantasy into theatricality. Most of the members of the Art Ensemble of Chicago wear face paint for performances. I believe you usually don't.
I sweat too much. I'd have that paint all in my mouth. It'd be all down in my horn, up in my nose. So I don't use it.
Was there ever any pressure on you to do it so that you'd fit in with the way everybody else was?
No, there's no pressure to fit in, because if you fit in with the Art Ensemble, you fit out.
Right.
Because it's about being individual, and it's about expressing yourself any way you want to. The whole idea of the paint is the tradition of the mask, and in order to prepare yourself to play music, you try to put yourself on another level. You want to become out of yourself, become the music itself, you know? And to do this, it requires changing something. I don't want to look the same way I look walking down the street as I do when I walk on the stage, because on the stage is when I'm presenting my craft and when I really have to concentrate and get into what I'm doing. And the change of costumes, the paint, all of this helps.
How did you join the art ensemble? Or I should say, how did you co-found it?
Well, what happened is I moved to Chicago. I was married at that time to Fontella Bass, and she got a hit called Rescue Me, and we moved to Chicago. And after playing in the studios and doing the jingles for about a year, I heard about Richard Abrams' experimental band, and I went and sat in with their experimental band, and the next day I was a member of the ACM, and Roscoe Mitchell and Joseph Jarman and I were all rehearsing together.
It must have seemed like a big leap at the time for you musically?
No, not actually. You have to understand that you don't go from bag to bag in this music. You don't say, well, I'm jazz and I'm R&B. I've always wanted to be a jazz musician. I've never wanted to be anything other than a jazz musician. But I also knew that I may have had to be a country and western musician to survive until I could play jazz for a living. So it all works together. One helps the other. I mean, my R&B experience helps me right now. My jazz experience helps me when I go to India or to Africa to play. You know, if you can play bebop, you can play just about anything. You know all the patterns of just about any music in the world. So I can use my bebop experience to help me play Chinese music. I can use the Chinese experience to help me further enhance or play something new on something else. So it all works together. You don't try to be just, you know, it's not just like one at a time. I'm R&B for a couple of years and I'm into jazz. It all kind of fuses together.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
The latest record from Lester Bowie's Brass Fantasy is called Serious Fun. It's on the Japanese label DIW. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams with a word about all things considered coming up this evening. We'll have a talk with Vytautas Landsbergis, the president of Lithuania, about attempts at compromise with Moscow on the issue of independence. There has been violence in Nepal, in the capital city of Kathmandu. Several people killed as police fired on demonstrators who were upset because the king of Nepal failed to declare a multi-party system in that country. The Mormon Church has selected its first black leader, NPR's Howard Berkus reports from Salt Lake City. And we'll have a conversation with John Waters, the director of the new film Crybaby, which takes place in Baltimore in 1954. That's coming up on All Things Considered.
The French film Camille Claudel is based on a true story of obsession and madness. It stars Isabella Gianni as Claudel and Gerard Depardieu as Auguste Rodin, her teacher, lover, and object of obsession. Critic at large Laurie Stone says the key to Claudel lies within her family.
The movie Camille Claudel whips across the screen like a force of nature. It's like the turbulent, elemental characters it depicts. The prodigious sculptor, Auguste Rodin, and Camille Claudel, a talented sculptor whom Rodin loved and collaborated with. We meet Claudel in 1885 when she's 20 and living in Paris. She's standing in a ditch, digging up clay with her hands and dumping it into an old valise she'll carry to her studio. Next, we see her with her family. Camille's mother finds her freakish and selfish because she rejects married traditional life. Her father, on the other hand, defends her, calling her uncompromising. These opening scenes establish the movie's charged themes, ones which are seldom portrayed in films. We see the sensuous play of artists with their raw materials. In showing the background of Claudel's family life, the film also brilliantly etches the reasons why she was derailed from her work. The movie shows that the pain of Claudel's mother's rejection, as well as Camille's challenge of it and shame over it, are lived out again and again. Her mother's disapproval matches society's suspicions of maverick women and finds a receptive medium inside Camille. Camille is 20 when she becomes Rodin's student. He is 44. he and his longtime mistress, Rose Bouret, have a child, but he becomes Camille's lover as well, and for 9 years the two share intimacy and art. When Camille becomes pregnant, she doesn't tell him. Instead, she asks him to marry her, to choose her over Rose. He refuses to decide. She leaves and has an abortion. Then her decline begins. The pieces she sculpts are all about threat, regret, and abandonment. She boards up the windows of her studio and goes out only at night. In 1914, after her father dies, her mother has her committed to a mental institution where she remains until her death in 1943. The movie explores both the external and internal problems that stymied Claudel. It shows the difficulty Camille had in defining herself artistically beyond the shadow of Rodin, in living as an independent female artist in the 19th century, in suffering love's loss and an abortion isolated from support. But it also probes the reasons why this gifted woman, who was loved and encouraged by her father, trained in her chosen field, and encouraged by the most influential artist of her time, wound up turning pain into her subject, then into her métier. She becomes completely obsessed by Rodin, stalking him, watching his windows. This extraordinary person ended up doing a fatal attraction turn, living out the most ordinary female story in the book. When Rodin thwarts her emotionally and thereby acts like her mother, she can't let go of the sense of betrayal. She feels only her victimization, discounting that she too has the power to wound. Although in reality, Rodin champions her work, she transforms her jealousy of his other lovers into his jealousy of her art. She goes so far as to smash her own sculptures in order to deny them to her imagined enemy. Seldom has so haunting an image been projected of a woman who feels that her desire to break away from her mother's role really is a crime for which she has to pay and pay.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and the author of the new novel Starting with Surge. Naomi Person produces our commentaries and music reviews. Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers produce our interviews. Our production assistants are Joan Tuohy and Roberta Shurrock. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, journalist Ernest Volkman on New York crime boss John Gotti and the role of organized crime in narcotics trafficking. And John Waters tells us about his new movie, Crybaby, his homage to the teen exploitation films of the 50s. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.